Hi everyone. Welcome to this special meeting of the Kensington Fire Protection District Emergency Preparedness Committee. It is December 5th, 2024 at 4:15 p.m. We're in the Kensington Community Center, Room 3, and we have a quorum, so we will ha call the roll. Director Levine here. Director Madugo not here. Public members: Doug Bevington not here. Lisa Corona not here. Katie Gluck. Yeah. Adrian Johnson. Peter Liddell not here. Paul Moss.
Here.
Dave Spath
Here.
and Don Domer is not here. We should add him to the agenda. We are joined on Zoom by our general manager, Mary Morris-Merga, and our consultant, Johnny Valenzuela. We begin with public comment. We have. Okay, public comment is for items that are not on the agenda. It seems like the. Is anyone want to make a public comment on items not on the agenda? All right. Oh, I should see on the Zoom. Nope, nothing on the Zoom. All right, moving to the consent calendar. This is approval of the minutes. Would anyone like to approve the minutes?
I'll second it.
Right, motion second. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? None. Motion carries 5-0, with five abstentions or five absences. Old business, report back on discussions about potential parking changes. Mary.
So I had a chance to speak with David Aranda. We've talked about this a couple of times. And I think I had reported back at a previous meeting that there was nothing official documented on a particular, I believe it was a cul-de-sac or a street where they had thought that there was something official for red flag days where they could alter the parking direction and that there would not be citations. But in talking with David Aranda, I know they're the KPPCSD, he's looking at more of a holistic overall evacuation and emergency approach plan that would kind of encompass this type of activity. So what we talked about is to kind of work with them and his timeline in potentially looking at a consultant that he's trying to work with on the overall program or evacuation plan, the overall, approach, so that we can incorporate things like this, because the worry is if we do, kind of the one-offs that we might do something that maybe a consultant expert would then later tell us is not a recommended approach. So also in talking with him, it seemed that and we've kind of talked about the topic a time or two, having a joint emergency preparedness committee with both agencies could be beneficial because these questions come up and we go back and forth to try to bring information back. If we looked at the possibility of having a joint committee between the two agencies, we might be able to tackle a little bit more because some of those things fall under their responsibility and some of those things we have our committee that works on. So it might be time to think about whether we could incorporate that if both agencies are interested in having kind of the, two board members on each agency participating in a joint committee. So that's, of course, something for the board to consider, but maybe the committee could discuss that. That would be a possibility that could help us with some of these areas.
Yes. Thanks, Mary. I think that's a great suggestion. I'll also add that the board policies that establish this committee for the KFPD includes the fourth point is articulation with the KPPCSD Standing Committee on Emergency Preparedness. Of course, that committee has never existed.
It used to exist. It exists
Oh,
no longer.
I see. It exists no longer. So it's clearly already in the intent of this committee to be in some way liaising with the KPPCSD Standing Committee. From my perspective, and from your point of like, if we want to be effective, we should do what it is to be effective, rather than just sit around and talk. Sorry for my computer for beeping. So something I'm in favor of.
And well, I'll speak both from committee member and also the president. Police board that I agree, I think it would be very useful to have a combined committee of the two districts, so, presumably chaired by two members of each board. And as I remember in the fire board's discussion of the plans for the future, one of the ideas that's been put forth is combining, having a joint committee between the two districts. So I think from the standpoint of the police district, we would encourage it, and probably the best way to bring that forward would be from the police district to request from the fire district the consideration of joining the two committees in the future.
I have a quick question about that, Mary. From a standpoint of needing to revise the board policies potentially, and that being a fairly arduous process, is there a difference between having a joint committee and having the standing committee of the KFPD and the standing committee of the KPPCSD happen to have all of their committee meetings together in the same room jointly, as opposed to having a joint committee, if you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I don't actually see any issue with that. Kind of goes hand in hand with another topic that we were talking about recently. So I'll investigate that, but I don't see an issue with that, because it would just be that they're meeting at the same time and they'd, you know, report on them separately, and yeah, mm-hmm. and that way they could converse as well. But they'd yeah. be both just noticed.
Easier
yeah.
To... yeah. Yeah, since yeah. our board policies already say we should work with the KPPCSD yeah. committee, then we wouldn't need to change any board policies, and we can get this show on the road more quickly.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll have to create a standing committee for the
yeah. Yeah. Does anyone else in the committee have any thoughts?
I'm 100% for it, period. I mean, I can only think of advantages and disadvantages, not even worth mentioning. They're just procedural.
Great. Katie or Adrian?
Yes.
Do you have any opinions to offer? Okay. Katie?
See how it goes.
All right. For the record, in case my microphone's too far from Katie, she said, it seems like a worthwhile endeavor. We should try it. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, it doesn't.
Okay. All right. they really want to be part of this meeting. Evil.
Is there sorry, so besides that, well, I guess in general, public comment on this item? Looks like I didn't see any in here.
I have a public comment. That sounds like a really good idea to me to try.
Awesome. Thank you very much. All right. If there's anything else you want to say on this topic of parking changes and the like, otherwise move on.
Can I ask Mary a question?
Yeah.
Mary, I hate to pick on it, but you use the word a holistic approach to parking. And so, you try to define that a little bit in this context? You mean just formal? Is that what you meant by holistic? Not
yeah, policy. I mean, just overall, yeah, just a more encompassing overall approach that would look at all paths and all facets, so that it's a fully encompassed plan.
All right.
And I think there is room, I think that can work. And I know I've used this example before, the risk of sounding like a broken record. I mean, where I live on Lake Drive, we got permission from the police. It's not really formal, but if we park in a different way and face the wrong way on the street on red flag days, I've been doing this for years. And they recently agreed again not to ticket people for doing that sort of thing. They essentially look the other way. And I assume that falls under a holistic approach.
Well, I think the holistic approach is to look at the community as a whole and see how parking could be changed, or mm-hmm. policies could be changed, similar to what you've just described. Mm-hmm. One of the keys to all of that, however, is the cooperation with the residents,
yes.
who observe those changes or those recommendations.
And that's the obstacle, for sure, mm-hmm. is getting people to really cooperate and can say, I don't have to.
Yeah. And certainly recognizing that in the case of your street, it's the easiest way to ensure evacuation occurs smoothly.
All right.
I want to ask, part of my public comment has to do with some of these.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. Give it an hour. Is that to do with parking as well as the clearing of the vegetation along the roads or whatever?
Yeah, say whatever portion. You got 3 minutes. Say whatever you'd like.
Okay. So, well, first I wanted to say that Wildcat Firewise was approved by NFPA for a 3-year extension of our status. We were the first community in Pennsylvania, and we're the first to get the extension, so we're pretty happy about that. And I enthusiastically support the plan for the removal of the flammable brush on the evacuation routes. And I participated actively as a monitor in the El Cerrito test of red flag day parking restrictions on Terrace Drive above the Arlington, in cooperation with the city and with Make El Cerrito Fire Safe, which I'm a part of. It was meant to be a trial run for future enforcement by El Cerrito, and the results are very applicable to many streets in Kensington with perilously limited ingress and egress. And this is what we learned. In brief, a number of residents ignored the signs, notices were put on their cars, and some were on vacation, even though the notices were put on, they did not move their car. Clearly, enforcement with fines and towing may be needed in future red flag days if we're going to really make it safe. Home construction contractors, Comcast and PG&E were working simultaneously on both sides of the street in a very narrow part of the upper terrace and lower terrace where it's hard to get by even with no parking. So this will require, I think, not just these are just suggestions. Require not just ticketing, but police enforcement to avoid catastrophic traffic blockage for emergency vehicles entering and residents leaving. But the one thing that we did find, because a lot of this is in this area was all in Wildcat Firewise, is educating neighbors by email and conversations between neighbors that I encouraged improved compliance on the second set of red flag day alerts. So it's kind of an informal, not no tickets, but discussion, encouragement, you may save yourself and your family. And I also took a walking count at various times of the vehicles on the various days during and after the red flag days. There was never a time there wasn't enough parking on one side of the street for every single car, not even including driveways. So people may protest, that's one of the things to say. And I suggest an informal encouragement of all residents to park on one side of the street during fire season, especially during red flag days, even if it's not absolutely legally required, before enforcement is implemented or required. Even if most residents comply and not all, this would save lives and homes. And you could see that even though a few cars were left, it would be still much easier for the emergency vehicles to get in, even though there were violators. And please, I want to also say that note that the northeast corner of Kensington, above Highland and all that, where I live, Kensington Court, Kensington Road, was not included in the last traffic evacuation study of a few years ago at all. And in future, all streets should be included. And there's one more thing I wanted to say, which is that I'm going to be posting a user-friendly guide to all possible cost-share and non-cost-share grants from Measure X, Diablo Fire Safe Council, Kensington. Hopefully we're going to have a vegetation on the edges of the road funding at some point. And this info is going to be on our website, the Wildcat Firewise, shared with others. And the goal is to maximize funding and fuel reduction options in residents' yard and east and behind all homes in Wildcat Canyon and Tilton Regional Park, where I've been working for 10 years in conjunction with the East Bay Regional Park District. So
awesome.
I think I made another thing.
You're good. Okay. Yeah, you go.
I can tell you that where I live, that effort has really worked. Okay, but
the informal,
yeah, discussion. Oh, yeah. No,
it did work.
It works, but I can tell you that maybe your neighbors are a little different. But I had to be mean at times. I mean, I wasn't nice about it after a while because I got tired of doing exactly what you said, going out in the morning on red flag day and see who moved their car off the streets and even did. We didn't encourage ticketing or anything. We just sort of shamed them. And I don't feel bad about it.
Actually, this is a trial run. We actually had to put on a little vest, and we had tickets that we put on. They weren't enforced, but they're going to start enforcing it, I believe, next year. I just driving by repeatedly during the day to check with people, and I pulled up next to someone. I was going to suggest that he move, but he was cursing. Nobody's going to make me do it. Not to me, but to himself. Nobody's going to make me move. And we were actually told part of the instructions that from the city of El Cerrito was we had to wear a vest that said the city of El Cerrito. And if anybody said anything or made any threats, we had to just completely walk away as quickly as possible because they want to avoid liability.
Yeah.
How does El Cerrito establish this as a policy, or are they creating an ordinance to require parking whatever direction during red flag days?
Yeah, I assume it's
an ordinance. I'm not sure, since the only reason I've learned so much about El Cerrito is because, half of my fire rise is in El Cerrito, and I've been going to the meetings to make El Cerrito fire safe. But I believe that it wasn't just on terrace above Arlington, but it was on parts of the terrace below Arlington and a few other streets. So these were just like trial runs to see how it went, to then gather evidence. But I think they do, for example, when there was construction and on one side and Comcast on the other side, the most narrow part of the street, that's a hideous kind of a situation.
Except that I can tell you that at least the one time I talked to PG&E personnel on the street, just like you're talking about, doing work, in fact, we were digging a trench.
Right, that's what
they
were doing.
For the gas water ranch, right? And so it was East Bay Mud personnel and PG&E. Now, these were just supervisors on site, but they said both of them said that they have orders to get the hell out of there if there is any indication of, say, wildfire.
I've heard that too. So it didn't happen though.
No. Well, that was a drill.
Right.
Big difference.
Okay. So I think just this is a suggestion. I don't have an authority. Is that the police would need to be alert to be able to intervene at that point, because the people that were working there said, this is my job, I don't know what to do. They weren't the supervisor.
Oh, yeah, I talked to the supervisor, and that helped. They just said, of course they have orders to get the hell out if their safety is in danger, which is most common sense. They're going to stop. Now, if they dug a big trench and built the street to put a line in,
but one thing they stopped, then they came back the next day, and it was just as bad. So I think the police may have to be involved
Want that for a drill, yeah.
But to answer your question, I think they're looking for an overall city policy to find the most dangerous streets and then to implement ticketing. Yeah.
Mary, when you were chatting, this would be a great question if we had David Aranda here. Mary, when you were chatting with David about all these parking changes, did mm-hmm. we ever get an answer about whether or not whether or not the KPP-CSD is empowered to pass a traffic ordinance or not?
Whether the KPP-CSD, whether they are?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think we asked that question specifically. I did not.
My gut is no. It is responsible for traffic enforcement, but
but the county. Yeah, I think that would be at the county level.
Yeah.
So, but that comes back to what we agree on here, which is that people talking to each other is maybe all we have. We may not be able to get the formal enforcement. And that did work. And the other thing that I didn't mention is the number of, I'm over 70, the number of people, 70s, 80s, and people with disabilities who are over 70 or not, that are living in these areas with the narrow exits. And the juniper that's going to catch fire on the side of the street. Well, it makes the situation more dangerous. They really don't. They can't just jump in their car.
I
think if you're talking about disabled people and their seniors, you really need to get your CERT group or your farmers together and organize for them. You have to put extra effort into that, like ADA will do. Okay, because if you've got your seniors and also families with little children, that's a mess, but I'm always saying, and you have to, one thing, if advisement is to do a premature evacuation. I'm Rick 5 days, if they can just get off the hill.
Right.
You know, for a day or two, mm-hmm. until the warning lifts and they come back. Because then you're already up. Something happens, you're already safe. And the confusion is off the road. You know, that's confusion. That's
never been discussed or mentioned, you know, at all. And we have no money or no authority. So all we have is the educational influence, which we have to, you know, get more of. And the other one thing that we did was with the Diablo FireSafe grant that was completed, we made a walking route in Rocket Park right behind the houses in case all the roads are blocked. Mm. So we have that now.
I think it's very possible for you to prioritize that and get together as the neighbors, because you're doing a really excellent job by on that and talking to the people. That's the best people to get people, your neighbors to conform, is to talk to them, or neighbor to neighbor.
Yep. Right?
Then they'll understand that you're concerned about them as well as yourself and everybody else, and that they all participate. This is what you do when you're part of society. Mm-hmm. I mean, function society. Mm-hmm. I pay an awful lot of taxes for everybody sort of to go to school. Because I'm part of society, okay? Every senior, fix them up with 4 or 5 neighbors that are gonna help them, because this way you might have one, but you don't know who's gonna be at work, who's gonna be picking up their kids from school, who's gonna be. So if you have 4 or 5 people, neighbors that are committed to helping that person, then the likelihood that someone's gonna show up is good.
Right. Totally agree. It's hard to get people to volunteer to do these things.
Indeed. All right.
I'm curious, is that just to get cars off the road, like in driveways? Is that main focus of the drill?
Well, we did one sign, and the city provided these lean-to traffic signs, which blew away and faded, and they had to come back. And put sandbags on them, and they put a second sandbag on the next day. So the technology is being worked out, but it was to park on one side.
That's
so there'd be enough room for at least maybe one car and one fire truck to get out. So because right now the way it was in the curvy parts, you couldn't have gotten you barely get a car out let alone a fire truck.
That's what we did. And
so just like,
everybody parking on one side facing the nearest exit, whether it's a long way or not. And in driveways facing out as much as possible.
Yeah, and then to use your technique, it was what my conclusion is, we're just going to tell people, please, even though it's not yet enforceable, on red flag days, here's the side of the street we should all park on.
It's a pain in the ass, frankly, and I did it for years. I passed it on to somebody else now who doesn't seem to want to be aggressive enough, and immediately it starts aggressive, and I don't know what to do about that. But I can tell you that if you get under cases, like I said, I believe in social shaming. You'd be surprised how it's only 1 or 2 people parking on the side they're not supposed to, next to a sign that says "Don't park here."
Yeah.
You can make them feel really bad and guilty.
Oh.
I have no problem with that.
And this goes into the
once the tickets start coming down.
But it goes into the shrub issues on the funding that may come for the shrubs on the side.
We'll get to that item later.
Okay.
Let's get back on track. Potential roles for CARO, Kensington Amateur Radio Organization, in an emergency. CARO. Paul, you said you had a couple of words to say on this.
I'll ask Dave to chime in also, because he did as much or more of the work on this than I've done. The people out here might remember that Matt McCombray from CARO gave us Kensington Amateur Radio Organization. I asked her to give a talk last meeting, and she did. And we went through the basics of how CARO is organized, operates, and what they might do in emergency. And it's the latter part I was focused on, because from my experience with an emergency group, search and rescue for 16 years, including right now, communications falls apart, you're really deep doo-doo at that point. So they were interested. To cut to the chase, they had 2 major concerns. One was that this person from CARO had the impression that the Emergency Operations Center in El Cerrito, primarily City Hall is the first choice, might not be functional, which is hard to believe. And that's not the case. Dave did some work on that, and we went back and looked at Chief Saylor's remarks about how the EOC would be activated and when, and it is most likely will be. There might be some limitations on access for CARO, et cetera. By access, I mean them being able to go into there and be directly involved in getting emergency auxiliary emergency communications out. But Dave and I spoke extensively about this, and we conveyed this to our sort of in a way, and that is our sort of our representative to the CARO organization. And we felt that the best approach at this point, since we don't see any really hard ass objection by the chiefs or anybody to getting CARO more involved or getting involved, period, would be that CARO has to come up with what their resources really are in the case of emergency. Like I envision, maybe there's a better way, but some kind of roster that says, okay, all these people are willing, if their families and properties are in good shape, they would go to this station in the field. They might be one or two people that would go to the Emergency Operations Center and provide auxiliary communications between using different frequencies on their FRS radios to communicate with neighborhoods. So she would, I don't know, did you notice in her email from a couple of days ago to Dave and I, she indicated that there was going to be a board meeting, and that was a CARO board meeting, sorry, last night, I believe. Yeah, it was going to be last night, and that she was going to bring all of this to that board, and that they would get back to us on exactly what they could provide. And then the idea is, and this was Dave's idea, a good one, then not initially we go to the chiefs and say, look, this is how many people and what kind of equipment CARO can provide and will operate and so forth. How can you best use us? I mean, that's really up to city authorities. So that's where we stand. We're waiting for feedback, and we're hoping that there are enough participants. I was encouraged to hear that they have, I believe she mentioned, Annette from Carol mentioned that they have about 40 members. Was that right? The number? Something like that. It was way more than I thought. Well, hopefully, if they can get even half of those people to commit to trying at least. You can't be sure who's going to show up and not an emergency, because one person may be really affected badly and the other not. But you get enough people to have a person posted at the EOC act as a liaison between the emergency management personnel and neighborhoods, because there are people out there, so they can get, they have another means of communicating, and especially directly with the neighborhoods. So that's what we're waiting to see. Do they have enough resources to approach the chief or chiefs, both of them, with confidence that, hey, we have a lot of people and we can be of help. What do you want to do with us? And in search and rescue, people are used for runners at the EOC, for example. It might sound like a crummy job, but it's kind of important, actually. They provide this auxiliary communications, backup communications, secondary, whatever you want to call it. And I'll stop there. That's where we're at.
Okay.
Dave, do you want
to? Well, I would only say that I think it speaks to the importance of maybe the CERT program, because United Albany is a good example. Mm-hmm. What they've done is they've created what they call block captains that work within a CERT group, and within that block captain organization, and the CERT organization, they have a HAM group as well. And what they do is they are able to determine within the CERT area, let's say with an earthquake, if people need help and they need first responder attention. So they get that information to the HAM person in the CERT area. He or she sends it to the EOC HAM representative, and they run down the hall, if you will, and give it to the EOC management group that then feeds it back into the first responders and the incident command center that's out there. So it seems to work, or at least it's structured very nicely. But since we don't even have a cert structure here in Kensington anymore, it sort of begs the question,
That was supposed to be their focus.
Right, but that looks critical, Katie. What's critical is standing up the various cert areas in Kensington. And there are only, I think, two that I'm aware of that actually exist.
Functional now.
Functional.
Yeah, there are six in theory, but there are two that are functional.
So until you have all those six standing up and structurally effective.
Well, you have to have people that will stand up to say, I'll be an area leader.
No, I understand that, but it's sort of...
That's it.
So until you have that, it's difficult, at least from my perspective, to see how this HAM system can work if you don't have a structure where the CERT groups will understand what's going on in their community, in their CERT area, and be able to feed the information back.
He said they had the HAM test. A couple of Saturdays ago, and 20 folks went to it, 16 passed. And you go, it's a thing where, years ago, I remember a boy back when we used to have a lot of studying, a lot of testing. And I have this program called Hand Cream, where you go into one day program, you go in the morning, and they drill you, and then you take the test. And the way the methodology is such that you're almost certain about it. And a lot of some of the old time folks are kind of crazy about that because they think you should know all the protocol and all this and that, everything ahead of time, and do it the very hard way, really. We had to do it. Yeah. And it's so very manageable. So, anyway, that was.
Wildcat FireWise has a GMRS group, and they have 25 people.
Yes.
And Armando Pinkerica, of course, has been organizing it for years. Mm-hmm. So we meet every Tuesday for 15 or 20 minutes. And we don't always do simulated exercises, sometimes it's just discussion. But basically, usually about 15 people that come in, sometimes up to 20. So we've just done some little exercises, but we could possibly do more exercises. And we don't have an active CERT group, but we do have GMRS group.
Annette McCombrey made it clear in the emails that she sent to Dave and I that they originally were trying to work with CERT, but as Dave already pointed out, CERT is entirely functional, at least not in all of Kansas.
Right.
So I don't think that's absolutely necessary. I would, if we wait for CERT to get organized to a point where we're back at the Caro group, that I'm going to be long gone by then. And that's not going to happen fast. So I envision just if you have enough CERT HAM operators in neighborhoods to cover all of Kensington, not just geographically or according to CERT areas, because the ability of the radio operators community is more important than a CERT area to me. And you're still going to get information from people that will take the responsibility of running around in their neighborhood and saying, hey, this is really bad and we need a medical unit up here.
Mm-hmm.
And that would do it for the time being. I must admit, I'm always in a rush. So I like that idea. I just have a sense that if we wait for CERT Kensington to get totally CERT organized, like Dave was talking about, that Albany is much less block captain for every block. This is going nowhere. That's what I think. So,
Can I ask, sorry if we already talked about this, but did we talk about the HAM versus CB radio versus satellite radio and why one is better or not?
Not really, except the HAM is in place.
Okay.
Enlarged, but
I'm just curious because I am not necessarily educated in this space, so I wouldn't know. But maybe it's the kind of thing where if there were handhelds, I know oil field people use sort of CB radios attached to cars because they have a battery there. I know that people use walkie talkies. What makes the most sense, and can you? Would there be Measure X funding to
We got radios for free somehow. I'm not a big other bathroom. And
okay.
So we all have hand licenses, but we're just using the GMRS, so nobody's, you know. But still, it's an effective form of communication. And we have a few doctors in the area, although there's liability issues. But if there was something extreme, you know, we'd be able to direct things a little bit. We need to have more practice doing that. But
I mean, I think neighborhoods use just FRS radios. We have late drive, and I bought four of them for $50 or something. Because the trouble is, they have really limited sort of line of sight.
No, but you sign up, and I have my call number and everything. I'll do that.
Okay. No, I'm just curious if, like, given that, like, police use, I think, CB, right? I'm just curious if, are we making good choices, even though HAM is the existing infrastructure, are we making good technical choices for what makes sense for the next 20 years? For people, I don't know.
I can help you with that.
Yeah.
If I can just take a minute. So three different radios that are being talked about. FRS is very short distance, just a few hundred yards.
Mm-hmm.
GMRS, which Tom was talking about, is generally the radios that the CERT groups operate on. And they have, depending on line of sight, 2 to 5 miles. So GMRS are very inexpensive. They can be purchased for less than $150. There's a cache of them right now that exists for free with his name escaped me for just a second. The gentleman that's been operating is the CERT volunteer coordinator in Kensington.
How many
years?
His name
Chris.
Chris Hilliard.
Chris Hilliard has a pile of them. Anyway, GMRS can be distributed throughout the community or purchased individually by the community themselves. The idea would be to tie a radio net, maybe a monthly radio net, a bi-monthly.
We have a weekly.
Or a weekly radio net, like communities like La Mirinda and other communities use, just so that citizens can practice perishable skills on how to communicate with the HAM nodes. The HAM node then communicates into the EOC. So these GMRS radios are the most useful because they have more than just a few block radius, easy to operate, requires a minimum amount of training, procedural license.
Sometimes we just do like exercises to get people more. I mean, it's going to be stationed in Point Richmond and often they can hear us there. So.
And these things are not all linear, right? They can be dual or parallel processes. So standing up a HAM node network isn't predicated on putting an entire CERT network within the city. You want these things are additive and not linear.
And I see that approach as being something that can be done relatively fast compared to all these other options.
Which I agree, we can look to the future, but you know, we just got lucky with the last
super
fire
low
season.
Cost, but you need a nerd expert to be coordinating.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, I'm not like a Luddite, but I still am not following exactly what you're saying from before, or, you know, more so now that you explained it. But I would just say it sounds like a great idea. How can we make it publicly acceptable as like something that an average person with average intelligence can manage? I know we all do our taxes, which are like, you know, absurdly complex for no reason. So let's, like, what can we do to, as a committee, to make this a little more publicly accessible or to beyond the HAM idea is my point. Because I know we got into some deep dives about the training and the HAM program and this and the that, but if there's a faster, less technically,
there absolutely is. HAM
is
a much more complicated process to go through.
Yeah.
And it's not necessary for the average resident to be able to communicate with an interface to the emergency responders, never directed to the emergency responders. So there could be a community outreach effort to let people know there is a way for you to communicate once if the departments decide to set up this HAM node.
Yeah.
Without that node, there's no one for the GMRS people to talk to. So it definitely requires an architectural buy-in from the departments. if the departments are interested in that, but they're absolutely us.
So close, sorry.
There's absolutely a membrane between the community talking amongst itself and disseminating finally that information to the first responders, and that has to be tightly regulated.
Would you say that I picked up from travels?
That is from Patrick.
Yeah. I felt an eagerness for him to, you know, that he wanted to get circle and he wanted to get his whole family, and that he was very pro radio community. And I think that he was asking to, you know, help us organize.
I mean, the training could be organized through the fire department, yeah. But I think that. I mean, we're kind of talking around several issues, and there's definitely a process without buying from the fire department.
That's the issue.
So there are people with training that are available. So the process I would think through this committee is to decide whether the fire department wants this, what they want it to look like, and then how can the community participate. There's enough critical mass in the community that we could get that started within the community once the procedural.
And
aspects
in place. The other point I was going to make is, like, what is the pressure that we can put on, like, phone companies like T-Mobile and AT&T to expand their reach and push them, as opposed to, I mean, if 35 of us tweet them, there's a strong chance they're going to look into it, and at least we would have maybe slightly better emergency alerts on our phones, which, you know, if I'm walking on the back area, I don't get. We could have gotten tsunamis.
That issue is a whole different issue.
It's a whole different issue, but it's all kind of like connected, I guess.
Well, specific to your issue about the cell, which I think you're talking about, is putting pressure on AT&T and Verizon isn't the right pressure, I guess you could say, because AT&T came into Kensington and wanted to put in 6 towers.
And nobody wants that.
And nobody wanted any.
Yeah.
For reasons that were not valid, be that as it meant, at least from my perspective. So they put in 5, and from what I understand, they haven't stood them up full power, which is one reason why you and I don't even see the cellular connection in our house, even though we're only 2 blocks from this. So that's one thing. But I think your point's well taken, because first of all, I think it's up to the fire chief to decide how he wants this structure set up at the EOC so that information can be communicated from the community to the EOC. And what are the best ways to do that? And how is that going to be structured? Because you don't want 100 people with these systems all sending messages into the EOC. Which would, you know, overwhelm the system, and priorities will be, you know, thrown out the window. So I think Annette and her group are trying to do is understand from the chief what is best from his perspective moving forward, and then all of a sudden, communication device things that just eventually may come into place. I'm not sure. I'm certainly not conversant.
And that's already. Close, I mean, the operators with equipment are out there. The question is, will they come up with enough so that the chief could say, yeah, I think you have that many people. We're not talking about hundreds here. We're talking about enough to basically cover radio transmission-wise Kensington. And then I think almost any person out in the field that is a resident, if he or she has a big issue, can go over and just talk to that person. They know where they are. That to me is the simplest. It may not be the best, but it's the simplest thing that can be done in my lifetime compared to some of these others. I'm sorry. That's what I see.
And it seems to me it's doable, because from the example of a group in Wildcat Firewise, there's 25 people, and there's just one person who is the expert, and everybody else has gotten the radio, and we meet, and it's kind of fun. And then you see the people on the street, and it develops, you know, communication and togetherness. And we didn't have to wait for anybody to endorse it or sanction it. And we even got the radios for free. But you need some expert to organize it.
Right, but you have to have a structure. I mean, if you have 40 or 50 people with radios out there, all feeding into the EOC, it's going to be somewhat of a nightmare. Because you have to prioritize the importance of, different.
But Dave, that's easy enough to do. We do that comms with search and rescue. If somebody's got something important to say, it's like cold, you know.
Right.
There are orders for that. Establish priorities.
I think Karen's concept, because I've talked with this group and worked with this group, and they used their radio net during the CERT exercise that we held last week, mm-hmm. during the final training. Mm-hmm. Carol's concept is that they already understand how to route traffic, so they're willing to be the filter that can bring discernible information to the first responders and the EOC, and they would filter out the noise before mm-hmm. it ever got to the Carol person that's working in conjunction with the EOC.
There you go.
What I haven't heard Chief Saylor say is we want a Carol Echo Ham operator in the EOC. Has someone in this group heard that?
Yeah, I think when he said I'm working with Bobby Moody, mm-hmm. that's my person, on a standard operating guideline. For the presence of the Carol Echo at the EOC. So he hasn't been averse to the idea.
Carol's concept is to put nodes in public spaces like all the parks, and those Carol people would man those nodes and then the master of the EOC.
What's a node?
Well, if you thought about the map of the city, I mean, Ham can operate one station to cover all Elstree and Kensington, but mm-hmm. they would have people in public parks that are physically located, listening to the incoming traffic from mm-hmm. the GMRS radios that were spread out throughout the community, mm-hmm. just wherever, maybe not even mapped, right? But you have to call down a specific channel. Carol uses channel 15, I think, for their exercises. So they would listen to the GMRS traffic, which is usually very hectic. People don't understand how to wait for traffic to come through them, but then they can talk among themselves. They also have the ability to take radio to text messaging, mm-hmm. so they can translate radio signals and turn them into SMS messages, things like that. So they would just geographically set up, and they ran an exercise like that last year.
So to piggyback on what you just said, geographically, Kensington is roughly 9/10 of a square mile.
Right.
A lot of hills and things in the way, but that interferes with FRS radios, but not Ham.
That's right. And not GMRS.
The whole town is 9/10 of a square mile?
Just about that.
Wow.
It's not even about a square mile.
Wow.
So, what would nobody's going to hold you to this. It's just from your expertise and your talent, I have no idea. And I'm not really comfortable with even throwing any number out there. What would you think would be a reasonable number of people to put out in the field if there were like a big earthquake? It involved all of Kensington, you know, maybe not like a wild
target. Kensington, Elstree, right? Because they want to mobilize.
How many people do you think would be out there?
I would think Carol would probably recommend between 5 and 10.
See, that's what I mean. Wouldn't be 40.
Not a large number of people. The GMRS radios are the key. The FRS radios are not going to be very effective because they're so short distance. The GMRS are higher power.
Geographically,
We're a bit in the weeds now.
Yeah, we are.
So
just 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. So are there any other public comments? Well, the only other public comment is Jim, and he can't talk in this meeting. So anything else that we want to say? No, because he's not in the committee. And actually, I guess today he can because Danielle's not here.
Yeah.
Jim, you got a public comment? All right. Let's just get back on track because it's already 5:04 and we still got a couple other things. So both of these items are were asked for by Danielle, and Danielle texted me. She's like, I won't be there. Maybe we should just pull them. Unless someone has a burning thing, particularly about the item B, the LRADs, which is to say, I think we're just waiting on the county to do the study that they said they were going to do. I don't know what Daniel wanted to talk about more about with that. But does anyone want to say anything about the LRADs?
I mean, it's in the county's tickets right now. Since mm-hmm. they said that they're looking at the county line right approach.
Yep.
And they've already, in previous discussions, as I recall, they seem to be more interested in controlling the LRADs at the county level. So.
Yeah. Okay. Public comment. All right. And if we end early, you can go back to going into the weeds. Last one, fire hardening along evacuation routes. So I had a sense that we were going to have some discussion on this topic, so I figured we should get to it. So this was also brought up by Danielle. I don't know exactly what, she has an example here in the agenda. Consider options such as creation of a local ordinance which officially defines evacuation routes, including how close from a material can be to an evacuation route. Mary, we're into a legal question. I know that the fire district can pass ordinances establishing building fire codes. Can we pass an ordinance to establish an evacuation route or like a fire code for streets? Is that a thing we can do?
I'm not sure about that. I'd have to ask that question.
Okay. It's a reasonable question. I don't know the answer. Come again? Yeah, it's probably, yeah. Or legal counsel.
Yeah.
Sorry for the dings.
But I'll be curious about what Daniel talks about post-flammable material. For example, Sunset is theoretically a evacuation area, but I'm not sure that it is. Has a lot of flammable material that
certainly has a lot of vegetation.
I'm not sure that that vegetation is likely as flammable as juniper or
which is everywhere,
right
along the sidewalks, right along the roads.
It's everywhere. So, mm-hmm. I guess from a standpoint of evacuation routes.
Well, that's terrible. Sunset, I don't know that it has to be highly flammable. A lot of those branches and boughs are right over the road. In fact, they form almost a nice appearing arch. Unless you're worried about wildfires, then it doesn't look so appealing.
Aesthetically nice, but
yes.
So
part of your public, I'm very much departing from normal board meeting procedure here since we're being very informal, but your public comment had some information about this. Would you like to elaborate?
Well, yeah, I've been studying all the 0 to 5 and all these regulations and what's implemented and what's not, and not that much is being implemented in general. But if you just put it in the streets, Sunset Magazine, circa the 60s and 70s, juniper is everywhere. Juniper is people's front doors. You tell them you wouldn't be able to leave your house if there's a fire, and but it doesn't sink in. Denial is not just a good relationship. So basically, you walk down even on some of the PG&E easements, they have hedges of juniper. It's not the only flammable thing, but it's severely flammable. So just in the fire hardening prevention of fire, but for the evacuation, it's even more crucial because if our home burns, that's one thing, but not being able to get out, that's something even worse. So just walk down any street and you'll see just horrendous flammable stuff. Right on the street and on the sidewalk. I don't know whether that's what you were, and also the cars will burn, even the ones that aren't Teslas.
So I guess the real question is, how do you address that mitigation issue?
Well, I agree with that, Jeremy.
Right, but what Danielle is talking about here is requiring that vegetation to be paired back or removed. And whether it's a legal question, just whether you can do it or not.
I mean, it would definitely make our town safe for sure. And it would make people able to exit. I don't know whether it's feasible.
Probably whether it's legal.
Or whether it's legal to do it.
Anything
5 foot
from the curb is
like
public domain.
It's a public right of way. Yeah, it's a different thing. So, it's a public right of way, and in California, the homeowners who own things on the other side have certain requirements for what they can do with a public right of way. They are responsible for maintaining it. I think Sunset is a good example where those trees are I mean, they're quite tall. It's not like someone can go out there on a weekend and trim back the canopy.
Tens of thousands of dollars.
Right, exactly. So it's there's a bit of a, even if we could pass an ordinance, which I'm not sure we can, we have an enforcement problem, which is to say that I guess the only way to enforce it is to start fining people tens of thousands of dollars for not doing it. And that's like not popular.
Well, a small way is, you know, working with the Diablo Fire Safe Council, working with Measure X, you know, people who can do some of the sweat equity, you can get the chipping day for Measure X. I mean, it's not going to make everything safe all at once, but if it makes it 20%, 30%, 40% more safe, maybe mm-hmm. it saves people on one street, mm-hmm. it, you know, so it's not, we're not going to get hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions that it would take to clear out all the juniper and stuff along the road. But, and also, you know, it's the insurance companies are probably going to cancel you for the 0 to 5, 0 to 10,
mm-hmm.
but the prevention, the evacuation issue is more of the, along the sidewalk, along the road.
Yeah, but it's the age-old problem of a socialized risk and a personalized harm. This town of Kensington or community of Kensington benefits from this, but it is the owner of those specific homes who has to bear the cost, unless somehow the fire district kicked in for doing that, which we do have the grant program that we've put out now. Johnny, what's the status of that grant program? Have we gone live with the application yet?
It'll be in my report.
Oh, sorry. I turned your sound off. Try again.
I was going to cover that in my report.
Okay.
Great.
We'll do that later.
Well, it's kind of interesting because there is precedent with regard to the sidewalks. You're supposed to keep sidewalks so that they're not dangerous.
Yeah.
So I know I have neighbors who have had their fix their sidewalk because of the cracks and so forth. And the county, I believe, was the county that brought that to bear on them.
Yes.
Yes. So there is a certain precedent for that.
I don't know what jerk that was. I said, I don't know which jerk that was.
Well, it was the jerk that twisted their ankles. When they hit a crack in the sidewalk.
Hint, it was me.
Measure X also has low income, no sweat equity required. Mm-hmm. Diablo Fire Safe is trying to get some no sweat equity, no investment on the part of low income. They're seeking low income people, but that makes it safe for everybody if anybody can remove anything. And also the Diablo Fire Safe, these cost share things, $5,000. It doesn't solve the problem, but it becomes an incentive that maybe we'll get people to continue on.
Oh,
yeah,
for sure.
I have a list I can send of non-flammable plants. I know, not for you, but there are things, and you won't be as sad as you think after you cut the stuff. That's my personal opinion.
Well, but you communicate that to people who have this wonderful,
beautiful
juniper.
Even Manzanita is highly flammable.
Oops.
Lots of things that are final board.
Yeah, I guess it's a fair point, Katie. I think the thought is like maybe when Johnny gets his report with the Girl Lab with the grant program, they can provide some suggestions. And I think there's already stuff in the law that has some planting suggestions.
Maybe we should look back to go back in history. I don't have a thing just back to me now. We have walked around Kensington probably at Sweden as well. And they did not, and it was just normal to see cedar shaped roofs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that's a normal. They look great. But so how do we get that done?
Yeah, so this is a thing that I've been sort of thinking about for some time and also chatting with the chief about, which is, you know, what gives the most bang for the buck in terms of, you know, emergency thing. The fire district has a very large surplus right now. How can that be used effectively? There's various suggestions made by various people that that maybe we should invest heavily in the East Bay Regional Parks District to put money into their area that abuts to us. There are various questions about whether or not that is the best use of funds, but that's one option. But one thing the chief has sort of pushed for is like home hardening in Kensington, right? In the sense of there are plenty of Kensington residents who are not, whose homes are not appropriately hardened, and we can list all of them. There's screens, there's the roofs, there's the juniper, and that is
not being enforced at the point of sale either.
Yeah, right. There's really you could imagine a mechanism whereby the Kensington Fire Protection District used Kensington taxpayer dollars to improve Kensington taxpayers' homes, not like they pay for things, but like where we create programs to do this. It could be for low-income people, maybe, you know, if you're an 80-year-old resident who's had your cedar shake roof for 30 something years and it probably needs replacing anyway, you know, and there's a need there, a financial need. Is that a place where we should be spending money? And this isn't just a benefit for that person's house. From the fire chief talking about it, is like if you have ember cast, right, from a big fire, and it catches on and it lands on a bunch of home hardened houses, hardened homes, it's less likely to light things on fire. But if it lands on the cedar shake roof in between all the home hardened roofs, then it doesn't matter that you've hardened your home because there's a house on fire next to you, and in Kensington it's about 5 feet from yours. So,
and that's the standard needs of transmission of fire.
Right, exactly.
So the point of sale, I think, is one of the, I mean, it doesn't solve it, but when houses are sold, they must be in compliance.
We don't have a way of doing that.
Ever.
Houses being sold and transferred, and we must have the automatic shut-off valves.
The earthquake gas valves. But that's at the county level.
So those enforcement mechanisms are in processes of being implemented through the county level and also in the city level in La Mirinda. So has your group investigated what's happening? Because you can codify these things on the county level, require these fire corridors on the street, on the streetscape.
I don't think we have. Mary, do you recall any time that we've done that? You have a longer memory than I do for this district.
No.
I turned off the sound again because I was mad if I could be beeping. Sorry, say again.
No, I have not.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. It's a reasonable thing to like ask about.
The thing is, right now, the only enforcement that people feel is the insurance cancellation. Other than that, we have very few weapons. But
you can do it through code enforcement violations.
Yeah.
Fines. It has to be codified properly.
It has to be codified, but it isn't.
Those mechanisms, but the community has to want them.
Yeah.
So those mechanisms are already in place in highly fire danger areas like the other side of the ridge, where they're already doing it in those number of places.
That's because they started years earlier.
Yeah.
We just need to start.
We have a focus.
The fire district, and for what it's worth, in any form it takes, whether it's a fire district or a CSD, has the ability to write fire codes for buildings. So I'm fairly certain we could pass such an ordinance without the county's agreement. You can always pass more stringent fire codes than the county. Our enforcement arm is El Cerrito, so we would have to and it's in the contract that El Cerrito will enforce whatever fire codes we have. We've never had a separate fire code distinct from El Cerrito, but that is another I don't want to call it a failure point, but like, you know, these are the things that would need to happen for that to happen. You pass an ordinance, an appropriate ordinance. It would probably be very involved. There's a lot of public hearings involved with passing an ordinance of that kind, because people will be mad. And the people who are happy won't show up to the meetings. And then we got to get fire department to enforce it. And then you've got to start, I mean, you got to find people for when they violate it. And then you've got to get enough buy-in from the community to have these in place that the board that created those fire codes doesn't get voted out at the next election, and then you repeal the fire ordinances. So this is definitely a thing that you need to take some time.
You already have the ability to find people because they haven't met the conditions of the on the fire, the county, I guess it's the county fire code.
Yeah.
And El Cerrito has doing the work for the district.
Yes.
And they are, in a sense, finding people, because if people don't go forward with the vegetation mitigation requirements, mm-hmm. then you will do it yourself and then charge the
Just for the public understanding and for the record of this, the way that this actually works, you don't really find someone for doing it. What you do is you send them a notice that says your property is in violation of the code. They get a letter. There's eventually a hearing before the fire district and says these people have been issued a notice that they need to cure this thing. They have up to 60 or 90 days to do that. Then if they haven't done it within whatever that time period is, the fire department would do it. Would actually, for vegetation management, they'd make the change. If it's roofing someone's house, I don't know how you do that.
That's a different issue.
Yeah.
What you deal with is the vegetation management side of things.
Right.
Not the house hardening. Now, if you want to follow what Lamarinda does and pass an ordinance that basically is very much similar to what the state is now working on regulations, this 0 to 5 mm-hmm. and so forth, but not only requires that 0 to 5 to be implemented, but then allows the enforcement agency to go onto the property and do a 360. Because right now, the only thing that El Cerrito Fire can do in enforcing the order is just put in the street, which makes no sense.
And going back in the house.
You know? Well, the other thing that bothers me is if you have a neighbor who complains, then they'll go on to the neighbor's property and look over, which seems to be totally unfair as far as I'm concerned, because they're reacting to the neighbor's complaint, while at the same time, someone down the street who has a mess in their backyard but it's never been looked at, creates just a...
Yeah, who do you choose first? There was one house that was flagged in the last meeting out on the Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be... But there's hundreds of houses like that that are just as bad. I mean, right.
But again, as I recall, that flag was as a result of a neighbor complaining about the backyard.
Right.
So,
yeah.
You know, so it's sort of missing the forest with the trees in a sense. sorry for that. But anyways, so I mean, if you really want to make this work, I would think that we as a community want to pass an ordinance that's much more comprehensive, similar to what Marina Moraga has, and that would certainly help to reduce at least some of the wildfire issues. The house hardening is a different
I mean, when you have a building that's out of code, then it doesn't get fixed until someone does $15,000 worth of work or tries to pull a permit.
When you say out of code, there isn't necessarily a code that...
I'm saying if the fire district passed a more stringent building code that said you can't have cedar shake roofs, right. That doesn't give the district the power to order people to get rid of their cedar shake roofs. It means that if people do major renovations or they try to replace that roof, then they have to do it if they pull a permit. And if they don't pull a permit, then someone needs to find out that they did it without pulling a permit, yada, yada, yada.
Or if they sell the property.
The only thing I see now is like these $5,000 grants, which I'm going to try to get neighbors to work on. It's an incentive. It's a drop in the bucket, but it starts people thinking and shows the neighbors. Mm-hmm. And that's really all we have right now.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very much impressed on your wildfire, FireWise approach. I want to see how the other FireWise communities go at this measure, because you've done a great job.
Hear, hear.
We'll see how the other Firewise groups do it.
If it's similar, and we're trying to share all of our knowledge and everything with them. And
appreciate it. All right, let's get to Johnny's presentation, because we're running short on time here. Johnny?
I'm here. I'm just getting things set up. Just 1 second.
No problem.
Are you able to see my
No. The dings are back.
Oh. Are you able to see that?
Yep.
Okay. Yep. All right. This is the Emergency Preparedness Coordinator's Report for December 2024. Sandbags were delivered to the Kensington parking lot before the last storm. I'll keep an eye on the weather, and I'll keep an eye on the inventory to make sure we have available resources for residents through the winter. The Kensington Library reached out to me to request a collaboration on presentation at the library. If you remember, when was it, in July, we had a really great turnout at an event that we did together. So I'm developing a series of topics, and I'll work with the library to schedule these events. And one of the first topics is going to be funding sources for some of the home hardening that needs to be done in the community. So I feel like that's a really timely topic, especially since we are launching the Hazardous Vegetation Removal Reimbursement Grant Program in the end of this month. So for the filing period, which opens the start of January. So I'm just finalizing a couple things on the application, and then we'll start putting the web access for the application together, so that way it's ready by the end of this month. So after the holidays, it should be ready to push out to the community. And I wanted to thank Lisa, Dave, and Paul for all their help to get this off the ground and ready for the public. And this is going to be a really great resource for the residents that are needing this type of assistance, and also the community at large as we work to reduce wildfire risk through the community. I'm working on a new map, which I plan to have ready for this month. So I'm going to give you a sneak peek right now with some of the updates on developing Firewise areas. So here's a snapshot. I know you probably can't see it really, really well because it's a very large format map. Don't pay attention to what colors mean what. It's just so that way you can see that there's different colors for different areas, just for the sake of this demonstration. But this is west. This is the southernmost part of Kensington, essentially west of the Arlington, or part of west of the Arlington. You can see green is Cerrito Canyon on the Kensington side. But these are all areas that are in talks right now to form Firewise areas. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the purple one is an existing Firewise community on the Berkeley side. So we're going to be butting up against them. So that way there's continuity along the boundary. But you can see there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 areas that we're identifying right now and moving through the process. The one in the center, the red, smaller, slender-looking one, that was a request that came through today. The orange one was a discussion that I had yesterday with somebody. So these are moving pretty quickly. And I'm actually really impressed with the amount of support and the willingness of Kensington residents to get this off the ground. So, I mean, it's really exciting because of these areas being defined, and, you know, because there's leadership in these smaller pockets, we're going to have greater outreach. And because of that, we're going to have a lot more success in moving the needle. So, it's really exciting to have this number of Firewise communities sprouting up in the community. It's really impressive. So just a thank you to all the community members that have supported growing this to what it is in a short period of time. And that concludes my report. I'm happy to take any questions. And if not, you can reach out to me to prepare@kensingtonfire.org.
Questions from the committee?
Actually, a question. The grant program have to be approved by the board?
It was.
Okay. So whatever Johnny finishes up with the questionnaire and the application and all that, does that have to go through you again? Or can you just put it out, be ready by the 1st of January?
Mary?
Excuse me. That was approved. So it's just the reimbursements that are going back for board approval.
All right.
But my question is, Mary, with regard to the actual application form and so forth, whatever has been completed by Johnny with some assistance from the rest of us, that's good to go then. In other words, the board does not have to review the application. You've accepted the concept, approved it, you did it.
Yeah, I'd have to find the motion itself to confirm.
Yeah, okay. I'll confirm that, but I didn't recall it needing to go back to them.
Right.
Do you have any recollection of when that was? Was it August?
August?
July or August. I can look back at my notes and I'll let you know, Mary.
Okay.
This is unrelated to the EPC committee, but a thing that I thought of today, Mary, is can we get a copy of the meeting, the approved meeting minutes attached to the meeting where it actually happens, as opposed to right now it shows up in the packet for the meeting where it's approved. But then that means you have to go skim through meetings to find which meeting approved the minutes for this meeting. Like it can't go to the August meeting and find the August minutes.
Yeah. And they should be, we should be posting them there. So we will get up to date on that. But yeah, you would normally see that.
I want to touch on one thing that was in discussion. In the packet that will go out, in the information for the removal reimbursement grant, there will be also information about what suggestions for replanting will be there. So I just wanted to touch, because I know Katie mentioned something like that.
And I found the motion. The motion was approve creating the hazardous vegetation removal reimbursement grant program with change that all proposed projects come back to the board for final approval. So
that's not the application. That's just the approval of specific properties for
money. Yeah, right.
Great reforms.
I think so.
Yeah.
Timestamped 2 hours, 38 minutes of that meeting. All right. Are there any other things we need to talk about today? I think we might be good.
I guess I should send it over because it's not on the agenda, but just encouraging thing is that I went along with Jim Watt. Jim, is he there, by the way?
Oh, no,
he was going to.
He signed off now.
He
signed off now.
He signed off. It's before, but I accompanied him. Other guy, Anthony.
Yeah,
spoke at mm-hmm. just the day before he did this walk with Patrick McIntyre, mm-hmm. His boss and assistant chief, and that was just the support of, as far as I could tell, of the whole idea of these Bay Regional Park District cooperation. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the next steps to get something like the Gabo Fire Safe Community established with the right, what's it called? Right of access, I think.
Right of entry.
Patrick has been unbelievable.
Right. So that's step. And to get that to start looking at what areas could be worked on.
How far was the right of entry into the park?
Well, it depends on what you ask for, but I've been focusing it, initially it was just Kensington because the fire ones have all the way to the Boy Scout camp, but basically, it's the part that we've been most intensive is the south end of Kensington Road that opens into that little area, which was when I moved in was impassable up till 10 years ago or something. And then all the way to the top of where you begin to go down to the school. So the idea, there's some sort of ultimate plan where it should be up to 200 feet.
That's
and we're trying to go for the 200 feet. This is the first time because they do the goats, they do the crew, sometimes they do the Civic Corps. But if there's always something left out because they have to go all the way from Richmond down to Chabot or wherever, you know. So the grant this year went, we got it to not everywhere, but 200 feet in a bunch of the places. Of course, it goes back, but and we have gotten some of the grants have applied a little bit all the way to the Kensington border, which is the first 6 houses from the south end of Kensington Road to where the city, where the town line is.
But you only can go 200 feet into that park itself.
Well, it's taken 10 years to get to almost to the 200.
Right. I guess my point is 200 seems to be a fair distance, but from the standpoint of wildfire coming out of the park, it strikes me as
it's
not going to happen.
It could be a drop in the bucket if the wind is really high.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I think we all acknowledge that if there's 50 mile an hour winds on a day and there's a fire coming up the hill, we're screwed no matter what. So,
and Jim isn't here, unfortunately, but exactly what is being sought with regard to clearing the overgrowth in the park below the school trail.
Here's a map.
Without, you know, they're doing it increasingly, but the extra funding that I've gotten has made it more extensive in the area where I've worked on, whereas no one else has been doing it. And, you know, so essentially you can get them. They only have so much time and so much money, so they don't get as far as we would like the 200 or 200 plus feet, because they have to get all the way down to wherever it is past the boundary. It's East Bay Regional Park, and not only is it East Bay Regional Park, but there's all East Bay Mud has easements on part of it. PG&E has easements on part of it. There's another, so it gets really complicated. They won't instantly let even like Diablo Fire Save money be used. It has to be through the right of entry. Patrick McIntyre went on the walks every year where he approves every place. So.
But in your point, Daniel, is if you have a wildfire that was 30 mile an hour, that's going to be just not going to much shipments, if any, whatsoever.
I don't think anything.
No. Nothing will stop it. Now, the embers will, in 60 seconds, the embers will come from across the hill over in Wildcat over to the houses.
So, essentially, East Bay Regional Park agreed this, and there's a 200 buffer that put top of the.
They barely agreed to that.
But they have agreed.
The part I worked on is 200 feet, but the part beyond that, where Kensington Road becomes El Cerrito, is not 200 feet. And then there's also the issue of people's backyards. Even in the places where we're clearing the 200 feet, it's the backyard is going to burn everybody's house.
Yeah, and
so we're trying to apply some of the funding for the backyards.
Right. Now, I know Jim envisions leaning up, reducing vegetation in that area, but if the park is already willing to go to 200 feet, then really it's a question of who's, it sounds like the park is willing to do that, but it's going to be on your nickel, for example, or...
They don't have enough funding or time to do the 200 feet because they have to go all the way down miles and miles south.
But it is, to me, it is a question of whose responsibility that is, and they're essentially placing the responsibility on you. Along the district to do that cleaning up because they're saying they don't have the resources to do it. But I would argue they have the responsibility because they're creating risk in that area. But that's how. East Bay is a popular plan. They're allowing the growth to occur. It's the risk they're creating. In my mind, it's their responsibility for reducing that risk, as opposed to putting the emphasis on the onus.
And they're publicly funded, right?
And
yes.
Patrick McIntyre is fantastic. I mean, there's limited resources.
I think that's the point. I mean,
that's why they're all resources. But
We need to get huge grants. I've been meeting, caucusing, I guess you could say, with Meg Elsevier Fire Safe, and they're looking at getting hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants. Anything we can get, because it's only gonna be cleared.
It's like the schools, like the schools are never gonna have enough money. That's why the parents are constantly doing fundraisers.
Katie, yes.
And sometimes those can take up to 7 years. Again, mm-hmm. They're okay on those environmental
until impact report.
So
yeah.
Kind of leave. I
all
gotta stop everything. Well, that's
the way it is. So they don't need any what they've agreed to already. They've agreed to 200 feet. Right?
Well, they haven't agreed to 200 feet, but you know that's in some sort of master plan, as I understand. But
and I guess I want to call out so. East Richmond Heights, earlier this last year, actually at the end of last year, the county approved about $1.1 million of Measure X funds to build a shaded fuel break along that area. So it was about 73 acres, and that's $1.1 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, these...
There just isn't the money to do what needs to be done.
It's quite expensive, in any case. This was another thing...
It's on people's houses.
And that was sort of the chief's point when I was talking to him about this, about to jump back to the house hardening thing and spending the dollars in Kensington is vegetation management is great, but it's also awful because, fun fact, plants grow back. Yeah, exactly. This isn't we don't put in $1 million now and then we're set for 30 years. We put in $1 million now and we're set for
this year. Things grew back more than they ever have in the 10 years I've been working on.
Yeah, so it is tricky. The nice thing about houses is if you put $100,000 or $1 million into home hardening efforts on houses, the houses don't grow back, don't grow fire risks back.
But at the same time, replacing vegetation with fire resistant vegetation, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But in the park, your point is well taken that mm-hmm. You can clean that up and just take it down the ground and a good rain the next year and it'll be right back.
Well, the thing is, they don't also come, you need to come in twice. They don't come in early in the spring, and so it's hard to get the invasives down so they don't grow back. They still will grow back, but to get them tamed for a few years.
And it's also not even as simple as take it down to the ground, because as we know, as anyone who's walked along the school trail knows, there was that time they nicked that one root off that tree, right when you go on by the entrance to Lake, and they lost that part of the root that was holding the path there, and the whole trail went down the hill. And so the goats
can be damaging.
Yeah. So
because we're at many slides.
So it sort of begs the question, do you want to throw a lot of money into even taking the vegetation down for 200 feet as opposed to emphasizing a different location?
It's a huge improvement unless there's a cataclysmic fire, in which case
improvement, but the fact remains that you have to continually to do it year after year. And that's my point.
But it is cheaper over time. There's ways to make it cheaper over time.
Yeah. The point is it's definitely we're over time. It's a longer discussion. It's something that's happening at the board level now about whether, you know, presumably Jim and Rick, who is our temporary committee on sort of capital improvements, and Jim is obviously talking a lot with East Bay Regional Parks now, will come back with, you know, maybe hopefully an idea or a plan for a pilot program, which is what we asked for. I don't know if we're going to get a lot more than a pilot program suggested, but there are obviously a lot of considerations. There's environmental ones. Is this the best way to spend your money? Is this, how do we actually do this? Can we even make a dent in what the pile of things is? Is it actually our responsibility, or is it something that we shouldn't be getting into? These are all real issues. They're all political issues. Some of them are factual issues, but a lot of them are political issues. And we'll just have to come to a decision as a board. But hopefully this committee will help. With that said, thank you, everyone. And we've reached the end of our agenda, so we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.